This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As we live history and scramble to take stock of how we got here, the president follows his own soon-to-be historic course. Pandemic and uprising be damned. His people need him, and he will not let them down, whatever the cost, as long as they sign a waiver.
He is under fire tonight for planning to hold a campaign rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma on June 19th.
Beyond the inevitable risk of spreading the virus, that the president would rally his supporters on June 19th in Tulsa scanned to many as a vicious 1-2 punch. After all, June 19th, or Juneteenth, marks the day in 1865 when the enslaved people of Texas learned they finally were free. Trump, in a rare concession to criticism, pushed his rally to June 20th. Still, amid the anti-racist protests that he's largely denounced, it's worth recalling that in 1921, Tulsa's Greenwood neighborhood was the site of the largest so-called race riot the nation has ever seen.
They decided, well, all right, we have to teach them a lesson. The Ku Klux decided that we have to teach them a lesson.
That's Olivia Hooker. Until her death in 2018, she was one of the last survivors of the massacre left to bear witness.
On June 1st, they began to systematically destroy neighborhoods. And they had airplanes dropping things down on people's houses. And they had made up their minds to clear the entire area of black people.
Russell Cobb is a professor at the University of Alberta and the author of The Great Oklahoma Swindle, Race, Religion, and Lies in America's Weirdest State. He's dived deep into the history of Greenwood, which began with a concession by the U.S. government to the, quote, five civilized tribes.
The Cherokee, the Muscogee Creek, Seminole, Choctaw, and Chickasaw. And they just happened to cover what we would consider the Old South, from Florida up to North Carolina, then westward into Mississippi and Arkansas. Now, they were labeled the five civilized tribes in part because they adopted slavery. I mean, this is a historical irony, right? The white Southerners filtering into that territory in the 17th, 18th century were saying, well, if you want to really assimilate to the civilization, you need to be farmers and establish white supremacy and hold black people in slavery. And so they did. The white man ran them out of the Southeast anyway, but they took their slaves with them. And when we get to the period right before the 20th century, this federal commission known as the Dawes Commission, trying to establish who exactly is a citizen of, say, the Cherokee Nation or the Creek Nation, are faced with this problem. What about the black freedmen, the descendants of the slaves? Now, we talk about Juneteenth, and Juneteenth in Oklahoma was actually even later than Texas. The last slaves in Indian Territory weren't freed until 1866. But when they were, they did become part of those indigenous nations. So here's the thing. We have this federal government saying, we're going to liquidate your government. And if you want to be a good citizen of the United States, you need to understand private property. So each tribal citizen is going to get more or less 160 acres. With one exception, the freedmen receive 160 acres of land in what is slated to become the new state of Oklahoma.
The land was poor. So where did the wealth come from?
It's right on top of what became the biggest oil field pre-World War I. And so Greenwood became Black Wall Street. That's where the money was, right? And it was a beacon. In the 19-teens, you start to see descendants of slaves, especially Texas and Mississippi, Alabama, come to Tulsa, come to Black Wall Street to make it like the American dream.
There were two black schools, 13 churches, two black movie theaters, a black public library.
And don't forget a roller skating rink.
Black-owned shops, black-owned hotels, even a black-owned newspaper, the Tulsa Star.
The Tulsa Star was started by A.J. Smitherman, and Smitherman was one of a handful of Black leaders who would not stand idly by as Oklahoma became more and more like the rest of the South. So as segregation was imposed, as lynching started to take place, as fake news started to spread about Black men attacking white women, Smitherman would denounce these things and even called for self-defense.
Greenwood was predominantly Black. Was it entirely Black?
It was not like there was this entirely Black Greenwood and this entirely white Tulsa. Remember, this was a place that was literally called Indian Territory just 20 years before this. So there's all kinds of mixing. And it's also a boomtown. You have white people going into Greenwood, Jewish merchants setting up shop in Greenwood, Native Americans, the freedmen, and then you have what they called at the time state Blacks because they were from states as opposed to Indian Territory. Tulsa was a Wild West town, but it was also a Bible Belt town, which it still is. And there were plenty of white people who were curious about Black clubs, music, dance. Greenwood attracted all the big names in jazz.
There's that famous song about Tulsa. Take me back to Tulsa. I'm too young to marry.
Drop me off at Archer. I'll walk down to Greenwood. Bob Wills is saying, you can put me on the white street and I'm going to walk down to Greenwood because that's where the good times are. And so the powder keg, the thing that made it explosive was that you had these two towns. They were intermixing in a lot of ways, both prosperous, but white Tulsa was increasingly adamant about enforcing white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And that's where the role of the media really comes in.
So there's one publication in particular that you flag in shaping white Tulsa's sentiments. That was the Tulsa Tribune. It was owned by Richard Lloyd Jones.
He was sort of a celebrity journalist. He was writing for Collier's Weekly. And he landed in Oklahoma and he said, this is the place for me. It's got white supremacy. It's got an economic boom going on. He was essentially handed the editorship of the Tulsa Democrat, which he turned into the Tulsa Tribune.
This paper of his repeatedly struck a couple of themes.
Yes. Tulsa was indeed a Wild West town. There was all kinds of police corruption. There was violence in the streets, bootlegging, et cetera, et cetera. But what Jones did was say, it's coming from Greenwood, or as he called it, Little Africa. And they went on a fact-finding mission, and they found white women dancing while a Black man played the piano. And they heard this infernal new music called jazz. But most importantly for them was that the Black Tulsans were getting a sense of equality. Both the Tribune and the World, we can't give the Tulsa World a free pass because both of those papers said that the number one issue that is creating tension is this Black man's notion of equality, which, of course, A.J. Smitherman was very adamant in saying in the Tulsa Star, yes, we are equal. We're equal under the law. If you're not going to protect our rights, we will stand up and protect them ourselves.
Jones publishes a note warning the mayor and the Tulsa police chief, if something isn't done, something's going to explode.
Yes, he actually, it's chilling. It's chilling to read that.
The precipitating event involved a young man named Dick Rowland, who's Black, and a white woman named Sarah Page.
Dick Rowland worked in a building called the Drexel Building, Shining Shoes. This was Memorial Day. So there wasn't anyone else in the elevator. And Rowland was going up to the top floor to use the segregated bathroom. Sarah Page operates the elevator. And so she takes him up there. And on the way back down, there's some sort of physical altercation between the two. What got out was that he had attempted to rape her. First of all, Sarah Page never actually pressed the charges. And furthermore, a lot of things suggest that many white Tulsans were looking for an event. One example that showed the dangers of social and racial equality. Page was a very poor, uneducated white girl who had recently relocated to Tulsa, it is possible that she was told to do this. There was certainly no evidence to even indict, much less convict, Rowland. And that story went directly to the Tulsa Tribune as the following headline: Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in an Elevator.
At the top of the interview, we heard the survivor, Olivia Hooker, talking about planes dropping things on people's houses. I mean, what would someone see if they were in a helicopter watching all of this?
They would have seen a war. The white attackers were often deputized. The police chief, Atkinson, was handing out badges like candy. White mobs looted gun stores and sports equipment stores for any kind of weapons they could find. Police themselves participated, and battle lines formed. Thousands of white attackers and black Tulsans who are prepared to not take this lying down. Obviously, they are vastly outnumbered, but they were also well-armed, and they took up defensive positions around the neighborhood. When the actual attack begins, survivors remember at 5 o'clock in the morning, this loud whistle going off, and then all of a sudden guns are blazing, and here come the airplanes.
What were they dropping?
Incendiary devices, so sort of Molotov cocktails. And that's why the fires spread so widely. Of course, the people are filing out of their houses, and a lot of them are being rounded up and put in internment camps, but some of them are just being shot right on their front porch. We don't know how many people died that way. Hundreds.
Now let's talk about how we remember. How did the regional and national media react?
The Tulsa media wants the world to know that there was a quote-unquote Negro uprising. And they pointed to the armed black defenders who came to stop the lynching of Dick Rowland in the courthouse. They said the blacks went crazy. They invaded white downtown. That's how it was remembered, was as a riot.
What about A.J. Smitherman, the editor of the Tulsa Star, the black-owned newspaper? Were there any countervailing voices?
There were. Smitherman was one of the main targets of the white mob. He got away and ended up in Buffalo, New York. There was a search warrant out for his arrest. Fortunately, he had enough people around him to protect him from the prosecution.
So let's go back to Richard Lloyd Jones. He became kind of a self-proclaimed spokesperson of Tulsa, and he publishes two antithetical op-eds on the topic. One he sends to a national wire service. The other he prints in his own publication. It's incredible.
Yeah, talk about a forked tongue. His one op-ed, which he disseminates for the national audience, says that the result of this race riot will be that blacks will have better homes. The splendid spirit that is characteristic of the aggressively progressive Tulsan, Tulsa will lift its head from this hour of shame to clean house. For his local audience, he writes an editorial. I don't think I can read.
Why not?
It's too vile. I'll just give you a little sense for it. Such a district as the old inn town must never be allowed in Tulsa again. This old inn town where a lot of bad N-words, and a bad N-word is the lowest thing that walks on 2 feet.
What happens after that?
There is a grand jury. There's an investigation. No one is ever prosecuted. I mean, think about that. The hundreds dead, the entire neighborhood completely flattened. No restitution is paid. No one is convicted of a crime. Richard Lloyd Jones continued publishing the Tulsa Tribune. His son inherited the paper, and then his grandson inherited the paper. They pursued a strategy of absolute silence around this event, and so did the Tulsa world. They just simply didn't want to talk about it.
You grew up in white Tulsa. What was your impression of the massacre?
I didn't have an impression of the massacre because I didn't know it happened. I grew up 2 miles south of where it took place. When it came time for our Oklahoma history class, we learned about the wonderfulness of the oil industry and of Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plains and the waving wheat. And we never heard a single thing, nothing about a race massacre or even a race riot. So it was not until I was in graduate school browsing the stacks, I don't know, I was probably killing time, and I saw this book about the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, and I went, what is this, some sort of historical novel, some sort of weird parallel history? I called friends, I called family and a black friend, and I said, did you ever hear about this? And he said, no. I mean, he said his parents warned him about this time when there was this great fire and the Klan. They just warned us, just be careful what you do, because there was a time when there was a lot of violence. And ever since then, I've just been sort of obsessed with it, because when you learn something like that, that took place so close to you and so intimately involved in your history, it feels like it changes your identity.
How so?
Well, my family were all in the oil industry, and my great-grandfather came to Tulsa at precisely this moment in time. Tulsa was the oil capital of the world, and beautiful Art Deco skyscrapers were being built, and lots of money was being made. And if anything, by the 80s and early 90s, there was this sort of nostalgia for those days, because Tulsa had kind of fallen on hard times. The price of oil was in the tank, and so there was this kind of romanticism about, oh, remember the glory days.
And then after?
I thought, well, not only is it based on a lie, the wealth that was built was stolen. It was stolen. We talked about the freedmen and the Native Americans and the allotments. That oil wealth was built on swindles. So it created a real change in how I thought about the place and the people where I grew up.
Russell, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Brooke. I'm just very glad you're interested in the story.
Russell Cobb is a professor at the University of Alberta and the author of The Great Oklahoma Swindle, Race, Religion, and Lies in America's Weirdest State.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio. We had more help from Eleanor Nash. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.